With U.S. sanctions casting their shadow on the import of vaccines into Iran, the inoculation program has been slow in the country. The Delta variant has now swept across Iran, killing at least 400 people every day. Covid-1 says it is speeding up its efforts to produce as many jabs as possible to stem the tide of Delta, as they claim their vaccine can terminate the new variant.
There is a test called virus neutralization test, or VNT, which studies how much a vaccine can protect the body against a virus. The Delta variant has not yet proven to be vaccine evading, but based on VNT experiments conducted on Coviran, it can neutralize the Delta variant as well.
So far, Coviran has produced and administered 7 million doses. The biotech firm says it will launch a third production facility, which will add 10 million more doses each month, boosting the overall output to 25 million. Given a monthly domestic demand of less than 15 million, Coviran says the extra doses will be exported to other countries. Coviran developers say their vaccine has so far covered 35% of the entire vaccination program in the country. They hope with the launching of the second production line here, the government will no longer need to rely on foreign jabs to inoculate its citizens. Yusuf Jalali from Coviran production facility in Alborz province.
Another episode in the British government's harsh immigration policy. A deportation flight planned for August 11th. On board, 19 people of Jamaican origins in this country for up to 30 years now.
The UK Home Office, responsible for immigration, has called those deportees foreign offenders, people who have come here and committed crimes and should expect to be removed.
But immigrant rights groups such as the Movement for Justice say the move is a reversal of an earlier agreement between the UK and Jamaican governments not to deport people who arrived in the UK as minors.
These are not people who should be deported. I deal very often with people who have lived in the country as children, or who have lived here for a very, very long time, or have been convicted of offences that aren't at the most serious end of the offences. So I have seen people for low-level drug dealing, not necessarily condoning it, but it is low-level drug dealing. There's all sorts of ideological and expert, you know, sort of, I suppose, societal issues why that sometimes happens to people.
Some are believed to be relatives of the Windrush generation, citizens of the British Empire who traveled to Britain between 1948 and 1973 after the government called on its colonies to send workers to help rebuild the country after World War II.
They came in the 1950s, have really gotten the short end of the stick. And remember, their ancestors have already been through slavery and colonialism and neo-colonialism and governorships and all sorts of awful systems that has always put them as second-class citizens. Then they came here and they were treated as second-class citizens. We've seen that with the Windrush scandal. And it is their children and grandchildren who are now being shackled and put on those planes. It's, you know, a further denigration of their rights.
Last year, 50 Britons of Jamaican descent were also forcibly removed. Many grew up in the UK. The hashtag Jamaica50 is still remembered.
People watching see the way that this government holds in such disrespect the contribution of West Indian, Caribbean and black people in this country. When will black lives matter once again?
The British government claims the deportations are everything to do with public safety or protecting victims. But rights campaigners disagree. They say the move is purely racist and political, made by a failing government appealing desperately to its racist base. Saeed Fariza, London.
After the fall of four key provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan into the hands of Taliban, the militants are now planning to capture Badakhshan, one of the strategic and border provinces in the northeast of Afghanistan. Military commanders say the fall of some provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan makes the battle difficult for government troops in Badakhshan, but Afghan forces will do their best to push back Taliban attacks.
God willing, we as the commando troops promised the residents of Faizabad to protect them against the militants' attacks. We pushed back an overnight attack of the enemy on some entrances of the city. They have suffered heavy casualties and cannot launch another attack soon.
Apart from the risk of disruptive impacts of the surging conflict in Afghanistan, the number of displaced Afghans is rising day by day due to escalation of violence in their home provinces. Since most of displaced Afghans have no access to humanitarian aid, they have called on both the government and the UN to urgently address the need of tens of thousands of families who have been forced to flee their homes.
The recent rise in violence, mainly the collapse of some big cities in northern and southern Afghanistan, has badly damaged the lives of our people. All the collapsed cities are populated areas. Hundreds of thousands of people have so far been displaced while they have no shelter. The world must pay attention to Afghanistan now.
Currently, 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan are the scene of fierce battles between the Taliban and Afghan troops. The Taliban militants have captured four provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan since Sunday. The Afghan president recently said the situation will change in favor of Afghan national security and defense forces in 6 months. This is while Taliban says it's not willing to approve even a ceasefire. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Prisoners Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Under the title, The Blockade and Raising Customs Tariffs is an American Crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Hadi government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden port amid the continued closure of Hodeida port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities. And this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender, but our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
People here say that Washington is backing the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation in the brutal war on their country.
The South Korean government extended its highest level of social distancing for 2 more weeks as new cases of COVID-19 drag on at over 1,500 per day, the most since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020.
The speed of the ongoing outbreak is slowing, but the size of the outbreak is still big, and this shows it's unclear if the outbreak will display a downward trajectory soon. The movement of people is not decreasing as much as desired, and the Delta variant cases continue to increase.
The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is responsible for more than half of the new cases. Private gatherings of more than 2 people after 6 p.m. are banned, and nightlife is largely shut down. The South Korean government had just announced the relaxation of social distancing guidelines when the fourth wave struck here in early July, forcing officials to reverse course. And pressure now is mounting for relief. Churches have been critical over restrictions on the number of people that can attend services, and unions have held large street rallies challenging the guidelines. Although most people observe government advisories, frustration is growing.
The level of social distancing has been increased and decreased and increased again. Personally, I think that social distancing has no point because it's nonsense. We are now in level 4 of social distancing, but the number of new cases has not decreased.
Officials say measures will be relaxed when case numbers fall. South Korea has so far vaccinated about 15% of the population, with the government now considering booster shots for those most vulnerable. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the 2 incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence, or Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. The situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week, the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not the vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the yellow vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
This is Pinbaldak, a Kiev-Ghan border crossing in southwest of Pakistan. North Taliban have shut it down, demanding Pakistan a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens. The complete closure of the border has suspended transportation of edible items and movement of thousands of people from both sides. The Taliban recaptured most of the border crossing with the neighboring countries of Afghanistan in an attempt to lay down a besiege of President Ashraf Ghani's beleaguered government in capital Kabul. Islamabad has completed 90% of wide fence of nearly 2,700 kilometer long porous border with Afghanistan to contain the movement of terrorists sneaking into Pakistan to carry out terrorist attacks. If visa restriction is removed, Islamabad fears there would be more infiltration of terrorists into Pakistan. Therefore, the government here is unlikely to concede to the Taliban demand of a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens.
It's not a legitimate government who can come up with a legitimate demand or where it can ask a relationship which is based state to state. It has to legitimize itself. It has to bring itself to an acceptable and internationally recognized position.
The Taliban claim to have recaptured 85% of Afghan territory, controlling over 260 districts, most of which after the withdrawal of US-led NATO forces. The clashes between the Taliban fighters and Afghan National Army have made thousands of families homeless, and many of them were caught in the crossfire, particularly in the southern parts of Afghanistan. The UN has warned an unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
The provincial capitals of Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, in particular, have come under significant pressure. This is a clear attempt by the Taliban to seize urban centers with the force of arms.
The ongoing talks between Taliban and President Ashraf Ghani's government in Doha have so far failed to take off. Both sides remain glued to their respective demands, which has heightened the fear of Taliban overtaking the rest of Afghanistan in near future. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Fred Hyatt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government is Designed for Failure, and a new study shows it's getting worse. Stay tuned for more. When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Americans have gone from irrational to just plain crazy. How crazy? The Post and the Partnership are tracking 799 of those positions, leaving out some advisory boards and less essential jobs. As of this week, only 112 of them have been filled. More than 6 months into his presidency, in other words, more than an eighth of the way through his term, Biden hardly has the beginning of an executive team in place. Recently, a visiting diplomat told experts he was struck by the disconnect between Biden's ambitious rhetoric about rebuilding alliances, promoting democracy, standing up to adversaries, and his meager agenda. He asked, "Where are the policies?" This isn't entirely fair. These are policies, but it's difficult to put meat on the bones of any agenda without ambassadors, assistant secretaries of state, and defense for different regions in the world, and more. At a about this point of every administration, you start to see stories assigning blame for the empty offices. Republicans will ask why Biden has nominated only 323 of the 799. Administration officials would say there is not much point in stacking up another few hundred nominees for obstructionists such as Senator Ted Cruz, who has been holding up State Department nominees to grandstand his opposition to the administration's stance on Russia-Germany natural gas pipeline. But the better question is, why do you think this way in the first place? Start with the 4,000 political positions every administration has to fill. This is totally out of line with every other democracy, says Max Steyer, who heads the partnership. It undercuts the professional civil service and promotes a kind of short-term thinking, since the average tenure for Senate confirmed appointees is about 2 years. Unfortunately, most of the challenges facing the society and the government can't be solved in 2 years. In 1997, the General Accounting Office cited cyber policy as a high-risk area for the federal government. Are we surprised that decades later it remains so? Climate change, equipping the government with appropriate technology, retraining the workforce for a changing economy, these all demand long-range thinking. So, as Americans have sadly been reminded, thus preparing for public health emergencies, requiring that 1,237 of those 4,000 political positions win Senate confirmation compounds the damage. This situation discourages qualified people from serving. The partnership reports that nominees during the Reagan administration waited an average of 56 days to be confirmed. By the Obama and Trump administrations, the waiting time had doubled to 112 days and 117 days, respectively. And that doesn't count the excruciating pre-nomination months when prospective appointees are being vetted by the White House. During the Obama administration, nominees spent a culminating 452 years bogged down in the confirmation process. Torture for them, but bad for the Senate too, which has to take time away from legislating. And debilitating for the government. Even after 2 years, many of the jobs will be unfilled. According to Vanderbilt University professor David E. Lewis, 30% of positions in the past three administrations never received a nomination in the first half of a term. Steyer says, I'm not saying you solve this problem and everything else disappears, but if you don't solve this problem, everything else stays indefinitely harder. And how do you solve it? You could start by abolishing some of the jobs altogether. One study found an average of 83 layers between top leadership and essential workers in federal agencies, the report says. The report found at least 40 positions that have been vacant since June 2016. If they have managed this long without anyone in those jobs, let's take a look at those positions. But more to the point, the Senate and the executive branch could agree to radically diminish the number of political positions and the number requiring confirmation. Have the change take place in the future, so everyone's political calculation is uncertain. The Senate could insist on true accountability, confirm the truly senior positions, let those officials appoint the teams they want, and then hold those executives responsible for results. Those executives would have an experienced, empowered civil service to rely on with institutional memory and long-term commitment. the country would have a government capable of taking on complex problems. Imagine the board of directors of a large corporation appointing a new chief executive and then forcing that executive to operate without a team for months and even years. Shareholders wouldn't stand for such absurdity. Why should taxpayers?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
Israel, the U.S., and a group of seven nations are still going on with their blame game against Iran for a drone attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off Oman last week. The UTOP official has also joined the chorus without offering any substantiated evidence. Tel Aviv has even threatened to take military action against Iran. Iran has rejected the allegations as baseless, while at the same time warning Israel against any adventurism. So what's behind this insistence on holding Iran responsible for the attack without offering any evidence?
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrikes on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
Okay, that was Mehdi Fadiman reporting. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Mehdi. Allow me to introduce the panelists that are joining me in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have activist and political commentator Leif Meruv from Beirut. Also, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me start with Beirut. Leif, what's behind this persistent blame game launched against Iran? I mean, how can one hold another responsible for an act in the absence of any solid evidence?
Well, because the United States as an empire and apartheid Israel as a supremacist entity, both of them believe that they don't have to apply to international law, and that they can live with this creation of rule of theirs that they call Western-based order or rule-based order. So it is, they have the right to attack the shipping lanes and containers and ships of others. They have that the right to attack sovereign territories of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and nobody else has the right to retaliate. This is as simple as it is. The United States and with it apartheid Israel have decided that the international law doesn't apply to them, and they want to apply their rule over others. And this is where the crux of the issue of resistance in Western Asia, in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen, is all about sovereignty and self-determination and continuing the struggle of decolonization that hasn't yet come to full fruition since the end of World War I and World War II.
Now turn to Brussels. Elijah, in 1967, Israel, during the war with Egypt, attacked a clearly marked U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty. It killed 34 crew members. The aim was to drag the U.S. into war with Egypt. Now, is Tel Aviv doing the same thing here again, trying to drag Washington into a war with Tehran?
Well, I don't think it's the same scenario today, because neither Israel nor the U.S., all the U.S. allies, are willing to confront Iran in an open war. What they're trying to do is to try to convince as many countries as possible to condemn Iran at the United Nations. Unfortunately, the world is not seeing and is not concentrating on the repetitive attacks that the Israelis have carried on against civilian ships and oil tankers in the open sea. It is something that the Israelis have recognized, acknowledged, and after that, the Americans and the Israelis are just trying to put pressure on Iran to bring it back to the nuclear table for the negotiation on a nuclear agreement that Iran is not willing to do unless the U.S. comply with its commitment signed in 2015. I don't think the aim is to carry on an attack or to try to confront or wage attack on Iran. I think is to mount the pressure and to increase different kind of pressure on Iran to force it to another agenda, particularly when Sayed Ibrahim Raisi is now in power and is not showing and sending many indications that he's not going to be flexible on the matter of Iranian national security.
Okay, Laith, Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that it's closely watching all suspicious moves by the U.S., U.K., and Israel in this region and is ready to neutralize any destabilizing plot. So my question is almost the same in the line I ask Elijah. Why is this happening at this juncture of time?
Well, look, there is two realities at play here. One of them is the fact that there is no return to the nuclear deal, because the United States and apartheid Israel want to add the discussion of Iran's ballistic missiles and the alliance for the resistance assets in Western Asia. And those are things that Iran is not willing to negotiate, and the new president was elected through the voters wanting an end to the Rouhani scam that happened of just wasting all these years on this agreement. And given the fact that the United States even didn't deliver on that original Iran nuclear deal because it claimed that it didn't pass it in the Congress or Senate, it's clear that nothing that the United States signs, even if it signs it through a Security Council resolution, is to be trusted, because there's no way any deal, no matter how much Iran gives to the United States and apartheid Israel, will be passed through the Congress. Congress and the Senate, the political bodies in the United States want to destroy Iran and the resistance in the region. Fortunate to Iran and to the resistance, that's the reality they cannot achieve. And that's where the conflict comes in the behavior of the United States. It is hitting left and right like a cat that is cornered. The empire knows its end is coming and is acting up in really destructive ways to its own self.
Okay, Elijah, Israel has attacked multiple Iranian ships in the past couple of years and brought daylight and got away with it. I mean, why didn't European and American leaders hold Israel responsible for those violations?
First of all, we cannot count on Europe because Europe is just aligned itself behind the U.S. for whatever U.S. wants. Secondly, the international community has double standards, and the problem is the word listen to them, and I don't think Iran should listen to them because everything they've been saying, it doesn't make any sense, it's against the international law. They are in clear violation of international laws, and they can't see what the Israelis are doing, including not only the attacks on oil tankers and other vessels, but the assassination of nuclear scientists and other destructive and sabotage attack in Iran. And that is a clear violation of international laws. Therefore, the only conclusion we can come out with is something that has been going on for many years now. The international law doesn't matter. It is only applied when the U.S. and its allies want it to apply on a particular country that is refusing the U.S. hegemony and is seeking the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from West Asia. So the double standard is nothing new. The world is no longer a fool, but we see that European diplomat and politician have no courage to stand against the Americans and can no longer even honor their commitment. And we saw that in 2018 when President Donald Trump shredded the nuclear deal and Europe was not able to stand by its commitment. Therefore, it is not surprising to see the US and Europe standing behind Israel for whatever Israel is doing. If we look also not only the attacks against Iran, but the violation against Lebanon, the thousand attacks against Syria and the continuous killing in Gaza of the Palestinian, all these crime, international crime and a violation of international laws is something that Israel has been carrying on since many decades under the watchful eyes and impotent eyes of the international community.
Now, Leith, do you share the same view as Elijah in that matter?
Well, clearly, the experience that the world has since end of World War II is that all these European countries are just vessels. They are occupied directly by American forces. And the struggle has been since that day to bring sovereignty to decolonizing nations in Asia and Africa and Latin America. Mm-hmm. And that has been the crux of the human struggle. And the only way that any nation received those sovereign rights of self-determination is through fighting it and defeating the colonizer. The Americans just, apartheid Israel acts as a beachhead war colony that extends the imperial order in the region. And they will fight to keep maintain that. One thing that is important to note is that just a few hours, some of the Iranian officials said that they are tracking an Israeli submarine escorted by two warships that are crossing towards the Red Sea, probably on their way to the Gulf. So no matter how much any logical being would understand that in a conflict that between Iran or with it, the resistance axis versus the United States and Israel, there'll be hundreds of thousands of losses of American soldiers and Israeli soldiers within minutes because of the direct missiles that will hit all the American bases in West Asia. That's a logical, anybody with a little bit brain can understand that. Mm-hmm. So watching how the United States and apartheid Israel are acting shows you acts of desperation. They really are probably just trying to bluff. I hope for that, because you know, no war is good for anybody.
Okay. Now, Elijah, in response to that unfounded allegation against Tehran attacking that Israeli managership off Oman, Tehran has made it clear that breach of security in the Persian Gulf waters is a red line. And Israel says it's ready to attack Iran. They publicized it recently, that we are ready to attack Iran. Iran says we are ready, if you dare do so. How likely is Tel Aviv to take military action against Iran?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I do not exclude the intelligence attacks, which means the sabotage and attack on ships or attack in different theater, because today all theaters, starting from Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, are all joined, and Israel can attack in any of these theaters. And I think Iran can do the same because it has strong allies and it has a strong presence. I don't think Israel dares to attack overtly Iran. Iran has the capability to defend itself. It shows the type of missiles Iran has managed to construct and the type of capability and advanced technology that it has reached, and it can reach Israel if Israel dares to attack Iran. I totally exclude a direct attack. I think the kind of tit for tat can continue, and I don't think Iran should just turn the other cheek to the Israelis when the Israelis try to do something, because as President Ibrahim Raisi told President Macron during the conversation yesterday, that Iran is determined to impose the strategy of deterrence. And by responding to any Israeli or American attack against Iran, this is how Iran is committed to impose strategic deterrence and prevent any attack against its territory or against its interests.
Okay, Leif, how do you look at this? What's the possibility of Israel attacking Iran militarily?
If they are logical, they will not be attacking. If they have any sense in their mind that they will not be attacking, because to me, it's clear the damage and weapons that are on each side, what will happen. We've seen already an example of just a small group like Hamas and Islamic Jihad facing off with apartheid Israel 2 months ago, the damage that that group caused to the supposed mighty Israeli forces. We saw a few days ago Hezbollah responding immediately to an attack by apartheid Israel on Lebanese territory. So it's very clear that the damage that will come from Iran, a nation of 90 plus million people, industrialized with advanced weapons, specifically missiles and drones, will exact a heavy price on the Israelis. So my only worry is that the Zionists and the imperialists have lost their mind. We've seen their society deteriorate. We've seen the outcomes of the elections of Trump and now Biden. It's an empire in decay, where it's like a chicken with its head cut off and it's flailing. So we don't know what crazy decisions they may take, and that's what everybody needs to be watching out for.
Okay. Now, Elijah, the Group of Seven says that Iran's behavior threatens international peace and security. It's Iran that proposed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, and talks with Persian Gulf littoral states to address any concerns if they have. And it's Iran that, as you know, helped Iraq get rid of Daesh terrorists and many more such instances. So who's a threat to regional security?
The only threat to the regional security I see is the presence of the U.S. forces in the Middle East and West Asia. We saw how Iran managed to agree on 3 meetings with Saudi Arabia in Iraq. We saw how the possibility between the countries of the Middle East can unite and can talk about their problems and try to sort out their problems without the U.S. intervention. And I think the U.S. is occupying Afghanistan, and after 20 years, it is forced to pull out, is occupying Iraq, and now it is forced to start thinking about
pulling out its forces. It is still occupying Syria. That is creating a real havoc in the Middle East. Why on earth the Americans are still in Syria? As Donald Trump said rightly, he's stealing the oil. That is destabilizing Syria as a sovereign country and stealing its wealth and preventing the economy and the country from recovering. This is destabilizing the country. What the U.S. is doing in Lebanon is exactly the same. What the U.S. is doing in Iraq is preventing Iraq from having contract with Siemens, a German company, to mount the attack on the government from the population, and so people are unhappy. So all that is created by the Americans. The Iranians have supported Syria according to the request of the Syrian government. He is willing to support Lebanon with oil and gas if the government is willing to take it. It is supporting Iraq with electricity. It is supporting Yemen, the small and poorest country in the Middle East, facing a huge war machine from the Saudis supported by the U.S. and its allies against the poor Yemeni people. That is destabilizing the region. And what they are doing is they continue their war. They haven't stopped. They continue bombing in Afghanistan. They continue occupying Syria. They continue presence in Iraq despite the decision of the Iraqi government asking them to pull out, and then continue destabilizing Lebanon by impoverishing the country and putting pressure on the economy and preventing the government from dealing with Russia or China or looking west and east. So right. All these are destabilizing factors that the Americans are responsible of in West Asia.
Okay. G7 ministers are also calling for the vessels in this region to be able to navigate freely and in accordance with international law. That's exactly what Iran has been for. Iran has even gone the extra mile, taken out to, further waters off its borders and protecting other vessels from different nationalities against pirate attacks. Let's have your comments in 1 minute, please.
Well, it's very clear that the United States and apartheid Israel are highway bandits, are pirates. We've seen how they had attacked Iranian vessels, bringing oil and products to Venezuela. We've seen Britain attempt to do that too, because it felt that it can bring it heydays back. We've seen apartheid Israel do that to attack ships coming to Syria and to Lebanon. We've seen what the Saudis have been doing, attacking ships coming to Yemen. And so we know clearly who are the pirates, who are the highway bandits, who are the lawless states, and that is the United States and apartheid Israel. And the struggle right now that Iran is at the crux of with this resistance axis will hopefully change the face of Western Asia to the better.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Thank you, my guest, activist and political commentator Laith Mehroof from Beirut, and journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier from Brussels. Stopping your host, Behrouz Zahir.